If the prospect of delight be wanting, which alone justifies the perusal of poetry, we may let the reputation of Dryden sleep in the manuals of literature. To those who are genuinely insensible of his genius, and these are probably the majority of living readers of poetry, we can only oppose illustrations of the following proposition: that their insensibility does not merely signify indifference to satire and wit, but lack of perception of qualities not confined to satire and wit, and present in the work of other poets whom these persons feel that they understand. To those whose taste in poetry is formed entirely upon the English poetry of the 19th century, to the majority, it is difficult to explain or excuse Dryden. The 20th century is still the 19th, although it may in time acquire its own character. The 19th century had, like every other, limited tastes and peculiar fashions, and like every other, it was unaware of its own limitations. Its tastes and fashions had no place for Dryden. Yet Dryden is one of the tests of a Catholic appreciation of poetry. He is a successor of Johnson, and therefore the descendant of Marlowe. He is the ancestor of nearly all that is best in the poetry of the 18th century. Once we have mastered Dryden, and by mastery is meant a full and essential enjoyment, not the enjoyment of a private, whimsical fashion, we can extract whatever enjoyment and edification there is in his contemporaries, Oldham, Denham, or the less remunerative Waller, and still more his successors, not only Pope, but Phillips, Churchill, Gray, Johnson, Cooper, Goldsmith. His inspiration is prolonged in Crabbe and Byron. It even extends, as Mr. Van Doren cleverly points out, to Poe. Even the poets responsible for the revolt were well acquainted with him. Wordsworth knew his work, and Keats invoked his aid. We cannot fully enjoy or rightly estimate 100 years of English poetry unless we fully enjoy Dryden. And to enjoy Dryden means to pass beyond the limitations of the 19th century into a new freedom. All of a piece throughout, thy chase had a beast in view, thy wars brought nothing about, thy lovers were all untrue, 'tis well an old age is out, and time to begin anew. The world's great age begins anew, the golden years return, the earth doth like a snake renew her winter weeds outworn. Heaven smiles and faiths and empires gleam like wrecks of a dissolving dream. The first of these passages is by Dryden, the second by Shelley. The second is found in the Oxford Book of English Verse, the first is not. Yet we might defy anyone to show that the second is superior on intrinsically poetic merit. It is easy to see why the second should appeal more readily to the 19th, and what is left of the 19th under the name of the 20th century. It is not so easy to see propriety in an image which divests a snake of a quote-unquote winter weeds, and this is a sort of blemish which would have been noticed more quickly by a contemporary of Dryden than by a contemporary of Shelley. These reflections are occasioned by an admirable book on Dryden which has appeared at this very turn of time, when taste is becoming more fluid and ready for a new mold. It is a book which every practitioner of English verse should study. The consideration is so thorough, the matter so compact, the appreciation so just, temperate, and enthusiastic, and supplied with such copious and well-chosen extracts from the poetry. The suggestion of astutely placed facts leads our thought so far that there only remain to mention as defects which do not detract from its value to omissions. The prose is not dealt with, and the plays are somewhat slighted. What is especially impressive is the exhibition of the very wide range of Dryden's work, shown by the quotations of every species. Everyone knows Macfleckno and parts of Absalom and Achitophel. In consequence, Dryden has sunk by the persons he has elevated to distinction, Shadwell of Settle, Shaftesbury, and Buckingham. Dryden was much more than a satirist. To dispose of him as a satirist is to place an obstacle in the way of our understanding. At all events, we must satisfy ourselves of our definition of the term satire. We must not allow our familiarity with the word to blind us to differences and refinements. We must not assume that satire is a fixed type, and fixed to the prosaic, suited only to prose. We must acknowledge that satire is not the same thing in the hands of two different writers of genius. The connotations of quote-unquote satire and of quote-unquote wit, in short, may be only prejudices of 19th century taste. Perhaps we think, after reading Mr. Van Doren's book, a juster view of Dryden may be given by beginning with some other portion of his work than his celebrated satires. But even here there is much more present, and much more that is poetry than is usually supposed. The piece of Dryden's which is the most fun, which is the most sustained display of surprise after surprise of wit from line to line, is Macfleckno. Dryden's method here is something very near to parody. He applies vocabulary, images, and ceremony which arouse epic association of grandeur to make an enemy helplessly ridiculous. But the effect, though disastrous for the enemy, is very different from that of the humor which merely belittles, such as the satire of Mark Twain. Dryden continually enhances. He makes his object great in a way contrary to expectation, and the total effect is due to the transformation of the ridiculous into poetry. As an example may be taken a fine passage plagiarized from Cooley, from lines which Dryden must have marked well, for he quotes them directly in one of his prefaces. Here is Cooley. "Where their vast courts the mother waters keep, and undisturbed by moons in silent sleep, beneath the dens where unfledged tempests lie, and infant winds their tender voices try." In Macfleckno this becomes, "Where their vast courts the mother's trumpets keep, and undisturbed by watch in silent sleep, near these a nursery erects its head, where queens are formed and future heroes bred, where unfledged actors learn to laugh and cry, where infant punks their tender voices try, and little Maximins the gods defy." The passage from Cooley is by no means despicable verse, but it is a commonplace description of commonly poetic objects. It has not the element of surprise so essential to poetry, and this Dryden provides. A clever versifier might have written Cooley's lines. Only a poet could have made what Dryden made of them. It is impossible to dismiss his verses as quote-unquote prosaic. Turn them into prose and they are transmuted, the fragrance is gone. The reproach of the prosaic leveled at Dryden rests upon a confusion between the emotions considered to be poetic, which is a matter allowing considerable latitude of fashion, and the result of personal emotion in poetry, and in the third place, there is the emotion depicted by the poet in some kinds of poetry, of which the Testament of Villon is an example. Again, there is the intellect, the originality and independence and clarity of what we vaguely call the poet's quote-unquote point of view. Our evaluation of poetry, in short, depends upon several considerations, upon the permanent and upon the mutable and upon the transitory. when we try to isolate the essentially poetic, we bring our pursuit in the end to something insignificant. Our standards vary with every poet whom we consider. All we can hope to do in the attempt to introduce some order into our preferences is to clarify our reasons for finding pleasure in the poetry that we like. With regard to Dryden, therefore, we can say this much. Our taste in English poetry has been largely founded upon a partial perception of the value of Shakespeare and Milton, a perception which dwells upon sublimity of theme and action. Shakespeare had a great deal more. He had nearly everything to satisfy our various desires for poetry. The point is that the depreciation or neglect of Dryden is not due to the fact that his work is not poetry, but to a prejudice that the material, the feelings out of which he built, is not poetic. Thus, Matthew Arnold observes, in mentioning Dryden and Pope together, that, quote, "Their poetry is conceived and composed in their wits. Genuine poetry is conceived in the soul." End quote. Arnold was, perhaps, not altogether the detached critic when he wrote this line. He may have been stirred to a defense of his own poetry, conceived and composed in the soul of a mid-century Oxford graduate. Pater remarks that Dryden, quote, "loved to emphasize the distinction between poetry and prose, a protest against their confusion coming with somewhat diminished effects from one whose poetry was so prosaic." End quote. But Dryden was right, and the sentence of Pater is cheap journalism. Hazlitt, who had perhaps the most uninteresting mind of all our distinguished critics, says, quote, "Dryden and Pope are the great masters of the artificial style of poetry in our language, as the poets of whom I have already treated, Chaucer, Spenser, Shakespeare, and Milton, were of the natural." End quote. In one sentence, Hazlitt has committed at least four crimes against taste. It is bad enough to lump Chaucer, Spenser, Shakespeare, and Milton together under the denomination of quote-unquote natural. It is bad to commit Shakespeare to one style only. It is bad to join Dryden and Pope together. But the last absurdity is the contrast of Milton, our greatest master of the artificial style, with Dryden, whose style, vocabulary, syntax, and order of thought is in a high degree natural. And what all these objections come to, we repeat, is repugnance for the material out of which Dryden's poetry is built. It would be truer to say, indeed, even in the form of the unpersuasive paradox, that Dryden is distinguished principally by his poetic ability. We prize him, as we do Mallarmé, for what he made of his material. Our estimate is only in part the appreciation of ingenuity. In the end, the result is poetry. Much of Dryden's unique merit consists in his ability to make the small into the great, the prosaic into the poetic, the trivial into the magnificent. In this it differs not only from Milton, who required a canvas of the largest size, but from Pope, who required one of the smallest. If you compare any satiric, quote-unquote, character of Pope with one of Dryden, you will see that the method and intention are widely divergent. When Pope alters, he diminishes. He is a master of miniature. The singular skill of his portrait of Edison, for example, in the Epistle to Arbuthnot, depends upon the justice and reserve, the apparent determination not to exaggerate. The genius of Pope is not for caricature, but the effect of the portraits of Dryden is to transform the object into something greater, as were transformed the verses of Cooley quoted above. "A fiery soul, which working out its way, fretted the pygmy body to decay, and o'er-informed the tenement of clay." These lines are not merely a magnificent tribute. They create the object which they contemplate. The poetry is purer than anything in Pope except the last lines of the Danciad. Dryden is, in fact, much nearer to the master of comic creation than to Pope. As in Jonson, the effect is far from laughter. The comic is the material, the result is poetry. The Civic Guards of Rhodes. The country rings around with loud alarms, and raw in fields the rude militia swarms, mouths without hands, maintained at vast expense, in peace a charge, in war a weak defense. Stout once a month they march, a blustering band, and ever, but in times of need, at hand. This was the morn, when, issuing on the guard, drawn up in rank and file, they stood prepared, of seeming arms to make a short essay, and hastened to be drunk, the business of the day. Sometimes the wit appears as a delicate flavor to the magnificence, as in Alexander's feast. Soothed with the sound, the king grew vain, fought all his battles o'er again, and thrice he routed all his foes, and thrice he slew the slain. The great advantage of Dryden over Milton is that while the former is always in control of his ascent and can rise or fall at will, and how masterfully, like his own Timotheus, he directs the transitions, the latter has elected a perch from which he cannot afford to fall, and from which he is in danger of slipping. Food alike those pure intelligential substances require, as doth your rational, and both contain within them every lower faculty of sense whereby they hear, see, smell, touch, taste, tasting concoct, digest, assimilate, and corporeal to incorporeal turn. Dryden might have made poetry out of that. His translation from Lucretius is poetry, but we have an ingenious example on which to test our contrast of Dryden and Milton. It is Dryden's opera, called The State of Innocence and Fall of Man, of which Nathaniel Lee neatly says in his preface, "Milton did the wealthy mind disclose, and rudely cast what you could well dispose. He roughly drew, on an old-fashioned ground, a chaos, for no perfect world were found till through the heap your mighty genius shined." In the author's preface, Dryden acknowledges his debt generously enough. Quote, "The original being undoubtedly one of the greatest, most noble, and most sublime poems which either this age or nation has produced." End quote. The poem begins auspiciously. Lucifer, is this the seat our conqueror has given? And this the climate we must change for heaven? These regions and this realm my wars have got. This mournful empire is the loser's lot. In liquid burnings or on dry to dwell is all the sad variety of hell. It is an early work. It is, on the whole, a feeble work. It is not deserving of sustained comparison with Paradise Lost. But all the sad variety of hell. Dryden is already stirring. He has assimilated what he could from Milton, and he has shown himself capable of producing as splendid verse. The capacity for assimilation and the consequent extent of range are conspicuous qualities of Dryden. He advanced and exhibited his variety by constant translation. And his translations of Horace, of Ovid, of Lucretius are admirable. His gravest defects are supposed to be displayed in his dramas, but if these were more read, they might be more praised. From the point of view of either the Elizabethan or the French drama, they are obviously inferior. But the charge of inferiority loses part of its force if we admit that Dryden was not quite trying to compete with either, but was pursuing a direction of his own. He created no character, and although his arrangements of plot manifest exceptional ingenuity, it is pure magnificence of diction, of poetic diction, that keeps his plays alive. How I loved, witness ye days and nights, and all ye hours that danced away with down upon your feet, as all your business were to count my passion. One day passed by, and nothing saw but love. Another came, and still 'twas only love. The suns were wearied out with looking on, and I untired with loving. I saw you every day, and all the day, and every day was still but as the first, so eager was I still to see you more. While within your arms I lay, the world fell mouldering from my hands each hour. Such language is pure Dryden. It sounds, in Mr. Van Doren's phrase, like a gong. All for Love, from which the lines are taken, is Dryden's best play, and this is perhaps the highest reach. In general, he is best in his plays when dealing with situations which do not demand great emotional concentration. When his situation is more trivial, and he can practice his art of making the small great. The backtalk between the emperor and his empress Nurmahal in Aurangzeb is admirable purple comedy. Emperor. Such virtue is the plague of human life. A virtuous woman, but a cursed wife. In vain of pompous chastity you're proud. Virtue's adultery of the tongue, when loud, I with less pain a prostitute could bear than the shrill sound of virtue, virtue here. In unchaste wives there's yet a kind of recompensing ease. Vice keeps them humble, gives them care to please. But against clamorous virtue, what defense? It stops our mouths and gives your noise pretense. What can be sweeter than our native home? Thither for ease and soft repose we come. Home is the sacred refuge of our life, secure from all approaches but a wife. If thence we fly, the cause admits no doubt. None but an inmate foe could force us out. Clamors our privacies uneasy make. Birds leave their nests disturbed, and beasts their haunts forsake. But drama is a mixed form. Pure magnificence will not carry it through. The poet who attempts to achieve a play by the single force of the word provokes comparison, however strictly he confine himself to his capacity, with poets of other gifts. Corneille and Racine do not attain their triumphs by magnificence of this sort. They have concentration also, and in the midst of their phrases, an undisturbed attention to the human soul as they knew it. Nor is Dryden unchallenged in his supreme ability to make the ridiculous or the trivial great. Avez-vous observé comme un cercueil de vieille sont presque aussi petits que celui d'un enfant? Those lines are the work of a man whose verse is as magnificent as Dryden's, and who could see profounder possibilities in wit and in violently joined images than ever were in Dryden's mind. For Dryden, with all his intellect, had a commonplace mind. His powers were, we believe, wider, but no greater than Milton's. He was confined by boundaries as impassable, though less straight. He bears a curious antithetical resemblance to Swinburne. Swinburne was also a master of words, but Swinburne's words are all suggestions and no denotation. If they suggest nothing, it is because they suggest too much. Dryden's words, on the other hand, are precise. They state immensely, but their suggestiveness is almost nothing. That short dark passage to a future state, that melancholy riddle of a breath, that something or that nothing after death is a riddle, but not melancholy enough in Dryden's splendid verse. The question, which has certainly been waiting, may justly be asked, whether, without this which Dryden lacks, verse can be poetry. What is man to decide what poetry is? Dryden's use of language is not, like that of Swinburne, weakening and demoralizing. Let us take as a final test his Elegy upon Oldham, which deserves not to be mutilated. Farewell, too little and too lately known, whom I began to think and call my own. For sure our souls were near allied, and thine cast in the same poetic mold with mine. One common note on either lyre did strike, and knaves and fools we both abhorred alike. To the same goal did both our studies drive. The last set out, the soonest did arrive. Thus Nisus fell upon this slippery place, whilst his young friend performed and won the race. O early ripe, to thy abundant store, what could advancing age have added more? It might, what nature never gives the young, have taught the numbers of thy native tongue. But satire needs not those, and wit will shine through the harsh cadence of a rugged line. A noble error, and but seldom made, when poets are by too much force betrayed. Thy generous fruits, though gathered ere their prime, still showed a quickness, and maturing time but mellows what we write to the dull sweets of rhyme. Once more, hail and farewell. Farewell, thou young, but too short, Marcellus of our tongue. Thou brows with ivy and with laurels bound, but fate and gloomy night encompass thee around. From the perfection of such an elegy we cannot detract. The lack of nebula is compensated by the satisfying completeness of the statement. Dryden lacked what his master Johnson possessed, a large and unique view of life. He lacked insight, he lacked profundity. But where Dryden fails to satisfy, the 19th century does not satisfy us either. And where that century has condemned him, it is itself condemned. In the next revolution of taste, it is possible that poets may turn to the study of Dryden. He remains one of those who have set standards for English verse, which it is desperate to ignore.